Now, you may think that every scholar you meet at the Folger Shakespeare Library is a genteel, somewhat dweeby, intellectual, fond of ancient things. I am here to tell you that they are badasses, one and all. And I'm sitting here with Heather Wolf, who's, what is your title?
Curator of Manuscripts and Archivist.
But also badass. It also says that on your business card.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or tablet or phone. I'm Austin Titchener, one third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, number 495, Curator of Manuscripts.
So, what do you think?
Well, first of all, the paper isn't right. It's not handmade rag paper, which is what it would have to be if it were from the 16th century.
But that's not our fault.
Yeah, no. I think if you go to the back, it says property of Ye Olde Office Depot.
The handwriting isn't right either.
What's the matter with it?
It's not in secretary hand, which is the hand that Shakespeare would have used.
He wrote it himself. He didn't use a secretary. Yeah. This is what we're telling you.
No, so I mean the style of handwriting in the period is called secretary hand. It's not about whether or not Shakespeare had a secretary.
With respect, I don't know where you got your certification.
Okay.
But
well, I think I need to end this discussion then, because it's not, I mean, it's, I can't authenticate it.
So you're a scholar. What would you call it?
I would call it a forgery.
That was Heather Wolf, the curator of manuscripts and archivist at the Folger Shakespeare Library, appearing with me and Reed Martin in the promo video for William Shakespeare's long-lost first play, Abridged. Heather wasn't acting. She was responding exactly as she would, really, if two idiots actually came in with a purported long-lost first play of William Shakespeare. After we shot that video, Heather sat down with me in the lovely Folger Gardens to explain what it is she really does at the Folger when she's not playing along with a couple of dopes.
Well, as curator of manuscripts, I'm in charge of all of the manuscripts in our collection. So that's items ranging anything handwritten or typewritten from the 12th century up to the present day. And I help interpret the collection. I help decide what and how things should be conserved, what needs to be digitized. We do exhibitions. I teach paleography, which is the study of early modern handwriting.
Oh my gosh.
So because most of the manuscripts from the 16th and 17th centuries are written in a style of handwriting that we really can't decipher today unless we know,
right,
or have the guide to figuring out what the letters look like in that period.
Well, short of a time machine, how do you learn this stuff?
It's not that hard to learn. It just takes a lot of patience.
So we
try to teach paleography without tears here, because in the past, people would go to archives, they'd have their research planned out, and they'd call up manuscripts and realize they couldn't read a single word. So we start out very gently with just forgetting the alphabet and then relearning the alphabet.
Oh, interesting.
But as if we were alive in the 16th or 17th century.
Right.
So you are introduced to things like butcher hook H's and hot cross bun C's, and we develop sort of nicknames and rhymes for different abbreviations and letter forms just to make it fun.
So it's not just a double F was an S.
No. I mean, and that's more of a typographic thing, but yes.
Oh, okay.
So
see?
It's learning the peculiarities of handwriting in that period. And then on top of that, you need to think about the abbreviations. And you need to remember that people were totally messy and inconsistent in their handwriting in that period, the same way we are today.
There weren't accepted spellings of things like Shakespeare's name.
No, there were very few spelling standards in the period, so you just have to be prepared for everything when you're reading manuscripts and printed text from this period. And so one thing we do when we teach handwriting here is we have the Oxford English Dictionary open on the computer as well, so that if we see a word that doesn't even look like a word to us, we can look it up in the Oxford English Dictionary and realize it's an alternative spelling to a very familiar word, and we can sort of see the history of
So the OED tracks spelling, the evolution of spellings of certain words.
Yes. So, you know, beyond the definition in the Oxford English Dictionary, you also get some of the earliest usages and contemporary usages. And then, you know, you can see how the word evolves through time, both in spelling and in meaning.
Oh, my gosh. And that this is just spelling. We haven't talked about ink, the ink that they use. What was that?
No. So they use something called iron gall ink, and most people would make their own ink. So if you look in recipe books from the period, in addition to the culinary and medicinal recipes, there are almost always recipes for different kinds of black ink. And it was made out of, it was called iron gall because two of the most important ingredients were the iron or the ferrous sulfate and then the gallnuts, which are these hard insect excretions that form these nuts that you grind up, and there's tannin in them, and that provides the color for the ink.
That's so cool. And coincidentally, Hard Insect Excretions is one of my favorite bands. Okay, so that's the ink. Mm-hmm. Then there's the paper that you used, which you schooled us quite painfully in the promo video. How did they make paper?
So
they didn't just run down to the ye olde office depot.
No, so paper, it was made out of basically old clothing that was made of linen, which was made of flax. So, but by the time it becomes paper, you're basically writing on, you know, used clothing that's been beaten down and broken up and processed. So that kind of paper then, after it was made by the papermakers from the used clothing, would get a special coating on it called sizing, and that is animal gelatin, basically. So all the random extra bits of the animal that were melted down, and the paper would be dipped in that, and that would make the paper receptive to the ink. Otherwise, it would be like writing on a paper towel or toilet paper.
Right.
The ink would just sort of seep in and feather. And the sizing would give it the sort of crispness and even surface to write on.
So that's paper. And then binding is a whole different thing.
Yeah. So blank books were popular then the way they are now. We have our moleskins and other sorts of notebooks. So people could either write on, you know, gatherings of sheets of paper that they would then take to the binder, who would bind together, or they could get a pre-bound blank book, or just write on plain sheets too, and fold them up and make them into a pamphlet.
So how emerging a technology were books at that time?
It was a very well-established technology.
It was.
In this period.
This is how well I know the history of books. When did we first start publishing books?
Printing books. So printing books started in the 15th century.
Okay.
So this is over, you know, by Shakespeare's time, we're over 150 years into printing.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that right now that doesn't seem that far, but I mean, I'm thinking of 150 years ago, we were just doing silent movies.
Right. Well, think how much text technology has changed in the past 20 years.
Just in our lifetimes.
We don't even recognize.
Yeah.
I mean, a typewriter is an antique now, so.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
We're moving much more swiftly than we did then.
So you learn how to identify all this stuff. Mm-hmm. How did you become an expert in Shakespeare? Did you study? Did you come to Shakespeare through the paperwork, or did you come to the paperwork through Shakespeare? Or
I'm actually not an expert in Shakespeare.
Dude, you're working for the Fulton Shakespeare Library.
I know. Don't tell them. Don't tell them.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
I know very little about Shakespeare.
I'm going to get you fired. This is not good. So it doesn't matter. So why do you work here? I guess it doesn't matter.
Well, the collection at the Folger Shakespeare Library is about so much more than Shakespeare. So our claim to fame are 82 first folios and our quartos of his individual plays. But we also look and collect things that reflect Shakespeare in his lifetime. So we look at European culture and society as a whole, and that's what we collect. So our book collection has basically anything printed in English in, you know, a 100-year time span, plus continental works from that period, so and other things that were printed in Latin and French and Spanish and Italian. And then the manuscript collection is, in addition to, you know, the post-Shakespeare material that records the performance history of Shakespeare, is really just family papers and letters and recipe books and blank books, we call them miscellanies, filled with all kinds of things that people were jotting down in the period. And what's so great about the manuscript collection is you can pull down any volume or pull out a letter, and you're just delighted by these voices that come out that you don't hear or see in print. Right. I mean, this is as close as you can get to hearing voices in that period, because there's no intermediary, there's no, you know, typesetter, or there's no mediation between, I mean, it's from voice or thought to manuscript, handwritten page.
Have you ever been trapped here in the Folger at night and heard actual voices?
There are many stories about the ghosts in the vault, and we do have staff members who have definite stories about strange things that have happened. That hasn't happened to me yet. But Mr. and Mrs. Folger are, their remains are buried in the Folger, and so I think that adds a certain level of possibility to mysterious things happening.
Talk about miscellanies.
You know what we should do? We should take it down to the Maxwell House Shakespeare Library. Because those guys are better than the Folgers.
Totally. Let's do that.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Reed Diamond, and you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Companies podcast.
Where can you RSC the RSC? On June 24th, 2016, we'll perform The Complete History of Comedy Abridged at the People's Bank Theater in Marietta, Ohio. Then on July 7th and 8th, we'll perform William Shakespeare's long-lost first play Abridged at Appalachian State in Boone, North Carolina. For the entire month of August, we'll perform William Shakespeare's long-lost first play Abridged at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival in August. We'll be at the Pleasance again. We're looking forward to it. And we have a bunch of performance dates this fall of 2016, all over the United States. As always, the very best way to stay up to date about all of our worldwide performance dates is to sign up for the Reduced Reader, our email newsletter. Go to ReducedShakespeare.com and click on the link to subscribe and check out our touring page for specific box office, venue, and ticket information. And now back to my conversation with Heather Wolf, the curator of manuscripts and archivist at the Folger Shakespeare Library.
Did people just really write with, you know, duck feathers?
Yes, the way quills are portrayed today, it would seem that everybody carried around a large plume or a peacock feather or something.
Right, but, or just a swan under one's arm,
And pluck the feathers as needed. People wrote with quill pens, which were generally made from goose feathers, from the wing feathers. Generally, I think it was like the second wing feather on the right wing. And there was a method which calligraphers still use today for preparing the feather to make it into a quill for writing. It involves hardening it and then pulling out the cartilage material that's inside of it and then cutting the quill, so creating a nib that when you dip the pen into the ink can sort of be taken up and then flow back down and be used as a pen. But another thing about the quills is they wouldn't, if you used a goose feather without cutting away the barb or the feathers, it would hit your nose. It would go inside your nose. It would hit your eyes. A goose feather is just impractical to write with. And so they would generally cut it down in half and then pull off the feathers as well. So it's a very humble looking writing instrument, not the one of Hollywood that we're familiar with today.
So now in our promo video, you infamously rejected the authenticity of William Shakespeare's long-lost first play Abridged. But in real life, you have been presented with folios and manuscripts. And have there been other authentic findings, and have there been other forgeries?
Yeah, well, I can't say that we've we definitely haven't discovered any forgeries. Sometimes people will bring in things that they think might be older than they really are.
Right.
And so then we say, no, this is actually, you know, a 19th century copper plate engraving of Shakespeare's will.
Oh, interesting.
Or something like that. So
in your mind, you're giving them the benefit of the doubt that this wasn't, it's not current forgery. It might have been a forgery back then, but you're not going to say that?
No. I mean, there's been a Shakespeare industry for hundreds of years.
Right.
So there have been reproductions made of these things for hundreds of years. And they're interesting in and of themselves, but they're not the real thing. And so we just try and make that clear. But it's amazing what people find under their beds and in their attics. And, you know, we haven't had anyone bring in any Shakespeare manuscripts, but we've certainly had people bring in early 17th century or late 16th century manuscripts that have very high research value.
Oh, cool.
And that we've been able to, you know, have become part of our collection.
Well, and Gail did tell me in our vault tour 5 years ago that, yes, there might well be a Shakespeare play or a bit of his handwriting on a piece of paper in an ancient British private library that nobody knows they have. Is it likely? Yeah. Probably not, but possible.
I think there are still many discoveries that can be made.
Right.
There are scraps of manuscripts all over the place. Our manuscripts in the Folger are well cataloged, but still, we don't know what's on every single page. We haven't transcribed everything on every single page, although we have a project going to try and do that.
Right.
But then there are also scraps of manuscripts and scraps of printed works that get pressed together to form bindings. And that's something we see sometimes when we're doing conservation work. You can see a bit of a manuscript sticking out or a printed work.
Underneath. Yeah.
And so there is a thought that, if there were any drafts of Shakespeare's plays, they would have been tossed out once the printed version came out, because why would you need a messy old draft of something if there was something in print, which is better? And so there's always the possibility of discoveries there. And there are new technologies that are non-invasive that we're hoping to use to be able to see through bindings so that you can see, you know, exactly what's there and if it's worth further investigation.
I remember watching that documentary, Shakespeare in Love, and where he tosses some bad pages he doesn't care for anymore into a fire. And I literally gasped in the movie theater.
Yes. Well, yeah, there's the fire theory. But also old paper was used as toilet paper as well, or to line, you know, for baking, it would line pie pans.
Wow.
So there was a culture of recycling in the period, of course, because we didn't have the, you know, trash pickup every Tuesday and Thursday.
Right.
And there are many uses for paper after you write on it.
And am I right in remembering that you have been instrumental in recovering at least one lost folio? Possibly stolen?
There was the Durham First Folio, which was brought in by someone about 6 or 7 years ago, and it was our conservators and our curator of book who quickly identified it as a First Folio that had been stolen from Durham Cathedral years prior.
Okay.
And it had the binding removed, but they were able to tell it was the Durham First Folio by looking at other evidence that had been recorded in earlier documentation relating to the First Folio in various censuses through the years. So that was very exciting for the Folger. It was even more exciting for Durham Cathedral to get their First Folio back.
But, and didn't you say, yeah, this looks great, could you come back tomorrow and then go call the FBI?
Yeah, so when the gentleman came in with the First Folio in the story, we did, our then librarian said to him, yeah, this is very interesting and we'd like to take a closer look at it. So do you mind if we keep it in our vault overnight so we can examine it further? And then we contacted the authorities.
What did I tell you? Badasses. One and all.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. Send us your ancient discoveries via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can also engage with us and other fans on Facebook or Twitter. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, reducedshakespeare.com. Thanks, as always, to webmaster Matt Rippey, director of forgeries Matthew Croak, music by John Weber and GarageBand. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Dawn Forsyth. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Reed Diamond, star of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Dollhouse, Underground, and Don Pedro in the Joss Whedon film version of Much Ado About Nothing. And finally, thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 495, 1485ths of the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
Strange and exciting things can happen at the Folger, and they continue to happen every day. It's a great place to work.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.